Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature a conversation between novelists Ruman Alam and Jonathan Leatham that took place as part of the Portland Book Festival in November 2020. There is a rich tradition in literature of the apocalyptic novel. As Alam and Leatham touch on in their rich conversation, the urgency of this tradition allows writers to explore what really matters to their characters and asks what we will keep and what we will forget when push comes to shove. The scope of these works ranges from, as Leatham says, widescreen narratives of entire societies being transformed, to the more intimate stories of how individuals, relationships, and families are shaped by these tragedies. The latter is the primary preoccupation of both these writers in their most recent novels. In Ruman Alam's Leave the World Behind, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, a blackout on the eastern seaboard forces two families together in an isolated rural house cut off from the outside world. And in award-winning Jonathan Leatham's The Arrest, two siblings find themselves in a world where most of what we take for granted, cars, computers, and airplanes, have quit working and their lives are further upended by a man with a nuclear-powered supercar. Here's Ruman.
Jonathan, it's so good to see you.
Yes, on screen. What a fun thing.
You and I talked before we started broadcasting, and we decided that we were going to hijack this event because there's no moderator. So we were going to make the rules, and we decided that we were not going to read. So we're not going to be reading from our work tonight. And we also agreed that rather than each one of us giving the same stump speech about our book that we always give, that I would give the stump speech about The Arrest, and you would give the stump speech about Leave the World Behind. So I'm going to take a crack at it right now. So,
okay, you go first.
The Arrest, as you just heard, Jonathan Leatham's 12th novel, which is, let's just reflect on that for a minute. The Arrest of the title describes a moment of global disruption in which technology ceases to work, precipitating what might be an apocalypse and what might be a liberation, a transition to an entirely new way of life. As we see in The Arrest, life continues in North America, and the way that it continues is sort of the ideal for yuppies like me, which is organic farms and sort of a back to the land ethos. In The Arrest, we meet this figure who is known as the journeyman, and we gradually understand that his backstory was in Hollywood, of all places. And someone is arriving to see the journeyman, and he's coming in a vehicle that you see depicted on the cover very fancifully, really caught the attention of both of my children. He has driven this nuclear-powered vehicle across the country to confront the journeyman and his sister. It's a book about what endures when our way of life changes, and I think that the answer is that what endures is art itself, but we will talk about that later. So that is my spiel. That is my stump speech for The Arrest. I hope that was
so
okay.
So fun to hear you do that job for me, Ruman, and I like it a lot. And it anticipates all kinds of things that we'll talk about. I bet that's going to happen in my attempt to talk about yours here as well. So this is Leave the World Behind. So this is an amazingly page-turning marvel of a book because it's very concentrated in time and space. It has the unities, right, that the Greek theater exalted, of time and space. A couple and their children leave Manhattan for what is meant to be a restorative and gracious vacation at an Airbnb in remote Long Island. So they've just, you know, treated themselves to this. And you travel with them out to this space and meet them each. Rahman works with an extraordinarily intimate kind of omniscient voice that x-rays these characters to their souls, but also leaves them mysteriously intact, you know, and I want to call it like a neutron bomb narration, because they're completely destroyed every time he glances at them and looks deep into their psyches. And yet they go on living, and they have these charming and even very kind of sympathetic desires to, you know, to just feel good about who they are. So there they are setting up shop in their Airbnb and picking the rooms and deciding who's going to cook what. And then there begin to be these ominous intimations of catastrophe. Something is not quite right. And the knock at the door comes, and it's the owners of the house, or so they say, who have fled Manhattan because of a somewhat unspecified catastrophe that has overtaken New York City. It consists at least partly of a power blackout. Are you beginning to be reminded of one book of the other? There's a feeling of of connection here. And the family, the vacationing family, the renters, have to deal with letting the owners come into the space, and they have to kind of collect their resources and figure out what to do about this thing that's going wrong, even as they're trying to figure out how much, to what extent they can trust one another. And it is not at all unimportant that the vacationing family is white and the owning family who've come and knocked at the door are black. And so this book has all kinds of overwhelming plot hooks that just come so naturally out of this one simple situation. And it has, well, lots of other elements I'll be asking you about. But one of the great things that happens is that the animal world reintroduces itself out of the background. Deer and flamingos and other kinds of animals, that some that you would expect on Long Island and others you might not expect on Long Island, but they're not part of the scenery anymore. They're doing something. It's like the animals got a memo. And you have to try to figure out what their agenda might be. It's a really intense book to read, and I'm doing what I heard you do too, which is fighting spoilers, because everyone should.
Yeah, I know that is a challenge. That is a challenge. When it's funny because I'm normally not someone who cares about spoilers, right? Like, I don't think that what I've been saying, like, you don't, if you know what happens to Emma Bovary, it doesn't change your reading experience.
Right.
But there's something about your book that, like, there are elements of surprise or revelation that you want to preserve. You want to preserve that reading experience. You want to go into it. It's fine if you go into it understanding what's written on the jacket copy, but you still want to have those moments of like, oh, here's the reward for the reading experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny to hear you talk about my book and to, you know, hear me talk about your book. It is plain that there is this shared interest. Why did we both write a book about the end of the world?
About it all shutting down.
What's been happening in the culture that you and I both were thinking about that?
Well, I mean, it's also worth pointing out, we're not totally alone. You can look at Lydia Millett's book this year and Don DeLillo's novella. I love Lydia's as well. And plenty of other things. Kim Stanley Robinson, the great science fiction writer, wrote an extraordinary book about planetary collapse. Of course, he's doing it with that kind of widescreen, this scientifically credible, you know, science fiction that I could never imagine being able to do myself. Whereas you and I have both kind of honed in on intimate experience under these circumstances, what happens to small groups of people.
When you're writing a book, I mean, Jonathan, like, what's the starting point for you for a novel? Is it like a premise, or is it a subject like the end of the world, or is it a premise like all technology has ceased working, or is it a character? Like, what's that first moment?
It really is usually kind of imagery, scenic imagery, iconography, tableau, things I want to see happen to characters that I've become interested in. So I feel like before I've identified what my themes are in any kind of abstract way, or you know, like when I hear it boiled down, I always think, well, yeah, I guess I was writing about that. But I thought about that weird vehicle you pointed to on the cover of the book, and I thought about it crossing the country and passing through different landscapes, and it being piloted by this abhorrent, ridiculous character who I was inventing. And I was like, I want to figure that out. That's interesting to me.
Where so the image for you, like the starting image for you, was the machine itself?
The machine and the town. You know, I guess this book has a really extreme disparity in it, because the small village in Maine, by putting it into this catastrophe I call the arrest, I've really only exaggerated some of the aspects of small town life in coastal Maine, which is a part of life I sometimes get to participate in. When I go there, which is that it's very rooted and very connected to the past. And there are families that have lived one generation after the next on the same road. And they, you know, that tumble down stone wall made out of field stones, they know that their great, great grandfather was the one who plowed those field stones out and made the wall. And a lot of people, there are, you know, like genius organic farmers who feed lots of people there, but a lot of other people also have some amount of garden, and almost everyone has a dug well. So it's also kind of like a prepper's paradise. It's a place where when you're there, you can't help thinking, you know, maybe everything could collapse and I would be fine here and nothing would change that much. I was just taking elements that kind of are part of that atmosphere and exaggerating them. And that is to say that, you know, your internet might not work that well there, and it might not matter as much. You're just separated from other things. And
it's part of the character of that place too, right? That sort of Yankee independence, right? Like there's like a pride and there's a libertarianism almost, right? Like, and that's sort of your interest in that place. And it's funny to hear you talk about it with such like firsthand experience and also like this sense of admiration, because I think that I always think of Brooklyn, where I am right now, when I'm thinking of your work. And so is it a shift in your ideal for what you wanted to write about, or like, does it reflect a change in you? Like, is it just the interest of an artist at a different age? Like, what is it about this mm-hmm. like that place versus the place where I am talking to you from right now?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know. I grew up in Brooklyn, and at a glance, I sound and look and act like someone who's probably still there or still there in their mind. And this happens to me in California all the time, that people just ID me instantly. Cause I've lived now in Southern California for a decade, and I write about other places, but I still accept that this is my, you know, it's sort of branded on my forehead.
It's your lot. Yeah.
But you know, going to New England as a kid, my mother, let's back up one generation. My mother was a Fresh Air Fund kid, and she was a city kid from Queens who didn't know what the countryside was like, and then was literally kind of granted this miraculous connection to a family in Vermont, in St. Johnsbury. And when I was young, for various reasons, my father was from the Midwest, so we were a New York family, but we had a car and we did go places sometimes. But I still was very much a product of the marvelous claustrophobia of an urban neighborhood. And I idealized these jaunts we would take to Vermont or Maine or the Catskills. So that landscape was always the image of, like, I don't know what you call it, like the antidote to being from New York was you wanted to go to the country, and, you know, or you might go to a summer camp and it might be just 2 weeks of the year. But so it isn't that new for me to like it there and to think of it as charged. But, you know, what's funny is in this book, Ruman, I actually realized when I created the descriptions of the towns and the way you cross from one to the other, and it's, you know, there are invisible boundaries. It's like, it's the way people live here. I was really just transposing what I know about neighborhoods. It's really still Carroll Gardens, Cobble Hill, and Boreham Hill. It's like, you know, if you're a kid and you cross Smith Street, everything changes. And that's how I read that landscape up in Maine, was the little towns were like neighborhoods in Brooklyn for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's this awareness of the geography and like I said, the geography informs the character of the experiment of the community that is established in this part of the country that you're writing about in this post-arrest universe. It's kind of like a, I mean, it reminded me of like the, it reminded me of Newhart, right? Like the sort of like the great New England ideal of like this community of eccentrics and this beautiful space, like all going about their business. But it's funny to hear you talk about that because that is what it is like to live in a big city in many of the same ways. Like, you know, these understood boundaries, these tacit boundaries and these sort of odd characters gathered together.
So now I need to turn the tables. Tell us about the origin image. What was the moment when you saw this book before you? What form did it take when you were anticipating it or discovering it?
I mean, just as you're describing an intimate relationship to what we could just sort of broadly call the country from your childhood, from your mother's childhood, like the notion of sort of like an escape from urban life, this book began, like I was on a vacation in a house exactly like the one I'm describing. We rented an Airbnb. I improved the Airbnb in fiction because that is what fiction allows you to do. But you know, we rented an Airbnb. It was absolutely beautiful in a part of Long Island that is not very cool. It is not a place where you would go to buy like a Missoni blanket and a scented candle. It's not that kind of Long Island. But we had this beautiful home for a week, and I knew that I wanted to write about that experience of what it's like to be in this place that doesn't exactly belong to you. But I wanted to locate in the domestic something much bigger. And I think that, I mean, what I usually say, and I think this is true, is that like the domestic, when deployed as a literary term, implies like something miniature or small or feminized or less important. And the big, broad, sweeping book like The Corrections and Freedom, I don't mean to unfairly use Jonathan Franzen, but he's a great example of this. Those books strike me as fundamentally domestic novels as well, especially Freedom, which is one of the best books about an American family I've read in the last two decades. You know, that the section about the mom in Freedom is just astonishing to me, but it's talked about as social because of the sex of the author and because of the this relationship between importance and heft. But I think that the domestic can show you a lot. And I wanted to push right through the literal house itself into the larger world and talk about the politics of the moment, the very pressing issue of the climate, which I think hangs over both of our books, this very bizarre and broken relationship we have to technology, which is again, something I think our books really, really share in common. And to try and interrogate them however I could. And so that was the attempt. I think that's where it began, like just being in that place. You know, as someone who lives in Brooklyn, it's very satisfying to go to a house that doesn't belong to you, that has a swimming pool, and just be like, I can breathe. I can, you know, see the stars. I can see deer, and I can feel that weird discomfort that I feel when I'm in the country of just being like, oh, I'm an animal, and I don't actually really know how to be an animal anymore because I can't even tell what the weather's like without looking at my phone. You know?
Yeah. So this thing, it's in both of our books. It's like the day you punch at it and it won't give you anything. Yeah. That feeling of being restored in your, as you say, in your bodily self, like, oh, I have to use my senses. I'm not going to transport through this tiny little window into other realities all the time. I'm not going to escape from the dinner conversation by like holding it below the level of the table tonight because it's not working. Oh no.
Like the arrest as a noun for the scenario you're describing is so, it's so benign, right? It's so, I don't know. It almost has like a beauty to it. The idea of like this, the suspension of all technology, but of course, and your book does engage with the ways in which it would be horrific. For a lot of the book, I was like, oh, this really sounds wonderful. And I'll tell you what felt more complicated to me was the coffee. So when the car arrives, when the machine arrives, and among the fittings of this particular astonishing car that Troutman is driving across the country is that it has a coffee maker. And I was thinking like, oh yeah, if we existed in some bucolic paradise of like organic carrots and like labor, my husband would have murdered me without coffee, right? Like it would have been a bloodbath, you know, it would have been like a, there's no way. And so even if your book is sort of like talking about this, there's almost an optimism to that perspective that like this disruption in the society we know might be a liberation, but it reminded me of how connected I am to this broken system that we actually live in. Like I couldn't live without coffee.
And our coffee is made for us by people who are largely very far away too. I mean, a lot of things are globalized and mediated. You know, we might at a glance oppose, our running shoe and our Netflix, but they're both caught up in these invisible networks, right?
Yeah.
When things become totally localized, I think there's a lot of idealization. I mean, one of the things I was chasing with this book was, you know, the feeling that a lot of people in fiction destroy the world because it would feel a lot better. That it's actually kind of those are consoling fictions, rehearsals of some kind of restoration or purity that might be a very suspect impulse. When I was a kid, there was a day when I was listening to WBAI and Alan Watts was doing one of his Alan Watts lectures, and I was transfixed because he's so charismatic and weird. And he said something that startled me, and I thought about it forever, which was that it's very bad to listen to the news and learn about faraway disasters. You shouldn't do this. That this is a really big mistake that contemporary life was making to learn about the flood or the tsunami or the famine. And I thought this is like cut. It seemed to fly in the face of the idea of a global, empathic, compassionate, recognizing of our connectedness and interreliant humanity. But he was sort of saying, all you can do is fail to take care of things that are actually under your care, things that are immediate and right for you. And so learning about these distant things mostly just paralyzes you. Now, it's not like I have a recommendation out of this for myself or anyone else, but I've thought about it at some level, this idea of the problem of our global consciousness and our proximity issues, like what's in front of you to take care of, as opposed to the things that you want to take care of that are out of your grasp. And I mean, we're all enmeshed in this in a way that's really confusing, because we have such access, such total access to remote realities.
Yeah, and we have this disbelief that like using a reusable metal straw instead of the disposable plastic straw will actually affect some, you know, it will do something, that we have this particular power in the world. It's more complicated than that. You know,
and you're guaranteed to be getting it wrong. You know, you'll learn later that the reusable metal straw was made maybe by somebody enslaved somewhere.
Right,
you know,
right,
you're never getting it right. But I mean, it was like when I felt so virtuous eating quinoa at one point, and then I was informed that that was destroying an entire society. But so in both of our books, we fool around with the question of, you know, we make a thought experiment of the reduction of the narrowing of what you can learn about remote situations. The characters in both our stories are sure that there's great suffering going on at this moment because of what they're seeing in front of them, but they can't confirm it, let alone affect it. I mean, one of the things I was interested in my book was what happens if you don't even know whether your parents who don't live where you live are still alive or not. And you do the same thing. Your characters are really haunted by the things you can be certain of, but you can't confirm, that are happening globally.
Yeah, it's terrifying. It's really terrifying. The notion of your world sort of shrinking down in this way is really scary. And I think in my book, you know, the book uses the sort of the language or conventions of thriller or horror, because I find that really horrifying. And what's so striking about The Arrest to me is that, as with so much of your work, it uses this sort of twist of, humor isn't exactly the right word, but like there's a, neither is levity, but like there's a way in which the perspective on the arrest, and you hear it even in the title, right? Even in that, the use of that particular noun to describe these conditions, it's not like the reckoning, right? Or, you know, the silencing. It's not like it's not like a terrifying Stephen King kind of moment. It's something more almost benign, but there's a lot of emotional stuff hidden beneath that. And that's what the book plays out, is this sort of like the connection between these two people that is more profound and has like a longer history. Do you think your book is funny?
I hope it's funny, but I always feel cursed when I say things like that, because it's such a terrible thing to explain or defend. You know, when people are like, I actually think almost all of my books are comedies, and yet, I mean, I think there are other things as well. They're doing other things as well, but the explanation for something puzzling is one I feel tongue-tied about saying, which is, oh, that part, I was just trying to be funny, you know? And I think I see the absurdity in terror, and I see the absurdity in a lot of situations, and try to underline it. But also, you know, you remind me of something that I think about what I do after all this time, is that I'm interested in the something less grandiose than the reckoning. You know, I mean, these characters at one point, they make fun of the book, The Road, for being so biblical and for being such a moral crosshairs. And the thing is, a lot of the time, we don't end up in the moral crosshairs. We end up looking at them from a side angle and wondering whether we should be in them. You know, like the way when the onset of this experience that we're in, which is so overwhelming and so profound and so dark and involves so much loss for so many people, but it also seemed to involve, for quite a lot of people, trying to find someone with a perfect sourdough starter, you know?
Yeah.
And this sense of the absurdity or the marginality of our experience to what we feel is most important, you know, the way we're always to one side of the reckoning, you know?
Yeah.
And actually maybe the reckoning is halfway just an inconvenience. It's like, oh, this is such a drag. The reckoning is going on and I was meaning to do this other thing.
I'm missing it. I'm stuck in this ridiculous sideshow. I'm missing the moral.
Maybe
reckoning.
I should go over there and be in the reckoning, but I didn't. I just didn't. That's not on my schedule for today.
But I have to say, though, with respect to like whether your books are comic or not, I think what you're talking about actually has less to do with the writing and you, and more to do with the experience of being a reader, which is that it's terrifying to go into a book and know and try to figure out whether or not you're allowed to laugh.
Uh-huh.
And I think a lot of readers assume that, like, they assume, like, this connection between, like, this performance of, you know, deep significance, like The Road, which I like The Road, but I do understand, I know exactly what you're talking about, this is, like, the silliness of it, and that, like, the notion that, like, anything that did make you chuckle or did give you the relief of a laugh couldn't be as grave or as significant.
Yeah.
But what I loved about The Arrest, which I read on vacation with my family, so I read it, I experienced it in a moment of like relief in my own life. And I found it really funny.
That's great. I love that. Well, I mean, one way we could relate our books is it's like your book is the first day of The Arrest. It's what it was like in that house in Long Island on the day my book began. And then 5 years later, my idiot characters are in the, you know, the foreground. But so here's what I want to do, because I want to, again, turn the tables. So your book comes on strong, as you said, with a kind of classical horror motif. You know, it's like the home invasion, the strangers. And this reminds me of very easily of all kinds of recent versions of those archetypes. You know, you have it in a lot of the most deservedly popular and profound horror films that have come along recently, is the almost the purification of this archetype of the family in a home and what's coming to the door, you know?
Yeah.
The sense of disturbance in your characters and how it does become very comic and you know, and also the shame and embarrassment, the drive to go get help that ends up with just getting lost because you have no GPS, and the guy comes back and he won't acknowledge that he didn't get anywhere. he just sort of parked by the side of the road and had a smoke. But so yeah. The same question for you, Roman. Do you think of this as a comic novel, among other things?
I do. Yeah, I do. I do. I hope it is. I hope that people have the experience of laughing at these characters and laughing at the absurdity of the situation. I think horror as a genre tends to walk on a line of like the gross out or the absurd or the ridiculous. And there's a gesture at the end where someone is like vomiting and it's talking about like the color of his vomit. And I thought that was so funny. Like I just, at a certain point I was like, everything that's happening is so terrifying that I don't know what to do but laugh.
Yeah. I don't want to undersell how scary your book is. It actually has one of the images I'm not going to spoil here because the book is too new. There's a thing in it that disturbed me very deeply. I'll tell you afterwards in the green room. I mean, you might know what it is.
I think what you're talking about is that there are certain conventions of narrative that are codified for a reason, that they carry like a primal significance. The reason that horror or science fiction develops conventions is because they're really efficient and they work really well. And so even if you don't watch horror films or read novels of horror, you recognize them. You know that when there's a group of people trapped and one person wanders away, nothing good is going to happen. And it's so satisfying to watch those things happen. And I feel like you are a writer who is really associated with this kind of understanding of the conventions of a certain kind of storytelling and then adapting those conventions or, you know, not even adapting them, but kind of like manipulating them to a different end.
Arousing the expectations in order to create a kind of anxiety about the fact that you're not necessarily going to see them play out the way they're meant to. Bringing the framework into the space so that, as you say, people know how these stories are meant to work semi-consciously. They've absorbed them from
all kinds of archetypal examples.
Well, you really cross a line in your book. You made a thing happen to a person that upset me.
I did violate one of the rules of those conventions, but so did you, actually, because I thought the arrest was going to function a certain way. And again, I don't want to spoil what happens, and I'm sort of trying to think of like how to talk about it. But what we understand over the course of the book is the relationship between this guy who is known as the journeyman inside this post-arrest universe and this man who is driving cross-country to meet him. And the nature of that relationship has to do with movies. And so I want to ask you, as a writer, your interest in the cinema as a form, as a form of cultural expression, like why in a book about the end of our entire way of life are you writing about Hollywood? Like what's the appeal for you there?
Thank you. That's a really great question. I mean, I think that one of the things that so I live in California now. One of the things that I sometimes explain to people is that I already always lived in California because I grew up watching The Late Show that, you know, the ideological power that's generated from this engine of storytelling and persuasion and intoxicating imagery. It's a place that I can't ever exit from in my life. And mostly I feel like that's okay, that's fun, but it's also a kind of nightmare or a hall of mirrors. And I think in this story where I reduced so many things out of the atmosphere of contemporary life, you know, these characters are experiencing a significant reduction in their story drunkenness. They're not Netflixing and chilling anymore.
Right.
And then it comes barreling back into their space.
Yeah.
And this raises all kinds of questions about like, was it actually okay? Or maybe what, you know, was it part of the problem? And Journeyman is complicit with it. He was an enabler of stories. You know, he wasn't the driver, but he might be the co-pilot, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the question is, like, if stories were part of the problem, what do you do if you were a storyteller? I mean, a little piece of this book comes out of the old joke that I used to have with myself. You know, I grew up in an artist's family and I've never really been capable of doing anything. You know, I couldn't build a fire without a blowtorch. And, but you always think, oh, but in the apocalypse, they'll need me. I'll be the storyteller. I'll be the one, you know, keeping the legends alive. Right. But what if they don't want that anymore? They're like, that's not, you're not invited as the storyteller. You can carry the water back and forth from the, we might have you clean up this muddy area over here, but we don't want your stories.
Do you think, though, as an artist, as a human being, that impulse towards story is fundamental? Like, do you see Hollywood as just an expression of this fundamental animal desire to sit around the campfire and tell one another stories? Like, that there's something in our wiring that requires that? Or do you actually think that...
I think that it's mixed up in consciousness in a very like Reese's peanut butter cup way that you can't get it out. It's just a big muddle because we were made of stories in a way. But what we do with our sense input is almost immediately a kind of storytelling. There's a million things I want to ask you and say about your book. I also know that we have a unique chance to have some audience questions.
Oh, yes, it's time. Let's take
a few, right? But it's so great talking with you about
likewise. Clearly, we could just keep going for like another hour, you know?
Well, let's get a couple of other voices in here.
Hi, I think we all could listen to you for hours and hours. This has been really great. But we do have questions rolling in. So Adam asks about point of view. Both of these books are third person. And there's a question about how you came to land that point of view.
I'll just say this. This is a great example for listening to your editors. I wrote this book in the third person to make the reader feel like they were participating in the same circumstances the characters are. And my editor said to me, it's annoying. The reader needs to know more than the characters know. And I had to crack how to do that. And the realization was to just have the book tell you. And so I introduced a different perspective into the book, which is what I think of as the voice of God, who is able to speak directly to the characters and liberate, like tell the reader something that the writers don't, that the characters don't know. And so it's third person, but it has this like other device inside of it. But I actually already had a preview of Jonathan's answer to this question, and it's a really good one. So I'm going to let him take it.
I'm going to tell you in a second, but first of all, I have to, if I can find it really quickly, Ramon's version of omniscience, that voice of God, is so great in this book. Maybe because it was introduced after you'd been doing, I guess,
I think
like
so.
Close third, because the sentences switch from voice of God telling you things that the characters would never think about themselves to the things that they are thinking about themselves really rapidly and freely. Yeah. And so you get these incredible moments like, one of the main characters is thinking about someone who works under her, whose name is Jocelyn. And she's thinking, Jocelyn had been born in South Carolina. Jocelyn of Korean parentage had been born in South Carolina. And Amanda continued to feel that the woman's mealy-mouthed accent was incongruous. This was so racist, she could never admit it to anyone. This is that neutron bomb voice of yours, Ramon, where you just level the character and yet they get to go on walking around and even commanding our interest and sympathy. It's kind of miraculous voice.
Oh, so thank you. Thank you.
The Arrest has this weird piece of compositional history. I wrote it in first person and I was sure that that was I had no doubt that that was how this book was going to work. It conformed in my projection to, it was modeled loosely on the way I'd use first person in another book called Chronic City, where there was this very garrulous but dense first person voice. Somebody who could express a lot and tell you a lot about a lot of impressions of things, but just didn't get it at the heart of the book, was totally missing the main point. And I thought that's the structure that I'm using again. And I wrote it that way. And it was I think the character was way too digressive and irritating and garrulous. And I realized that actually I wanted the tableau, the imagery and the situations to win out and not be constantly shrouded by this chatty, irritating narrator. And so I recast the entire book in third person, but it was the last revision. It was what I did at the 11th hour. So the book changed in this one really dramatic way, with point of view. Lucky question.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Liz has a question. She wants to know for each of you, what was one of your favorite parts of your novel to write? And maybe we'll start with Jonathan this time, just to keep it spicy.
Well, this was a joyful novel for me to write. It came, and despite this big reframing from first to third person, I never felt thrown out of this book. You know, I was always like, I'm digging it. I'm getting it. I'm doing what I want to do with this one. And it just felt really terrific. And there was I'm going to avoid my own spoiler now. There was a scene I wanted to write. And this has driven a few books where I have an image towards the very end of the book that I just want to see. I want to see it done. And I was like, but I don't let myself go ahead and write it ahead. Like the desire to get there drives the entire experience. So for 2 years, I was waiting to make this thing. And it's a very physical, peculiar thing. Like something moves into a different space in a way that I hope the reader can't have expected, but is very interested.
No, let me just tell you that there's no way the reader could expect how this book ends. So don't worry, mission accomplished on that level. Yeah.
So I just, you know, the day I finally get to do it, it's like, you know, it's like you've been staring at a corner of your ceiling that wasn't painted. And then one day you get out the paint that's the right color and you like, look at that.
I do like that your reward is like actually just more work.
Like more work, more labor.
That's
awesome.
that's what writing is.
I had a lot of fun when, I guess, I mentioned before that it was my editor who told me that there was this information gap that needed to be filled in between the characters and the reader. And when I solved that problem, when I came up with this voice and I got to deploy all of these details, I had a lot of fun thinking about the things that I find most terrifying. And it was almost like an act of exorcism to think them through and then bake them into the book. So when I was a kid, there was a famous case, and I'm going to forget the woman's name now, of a woman, a mother who drowned her children in the bathtub, which terrified me as a child, terrifies me to this day. I am terrified of being trapped in an elevator. I am terrified of plane crashes. I'm terrified of like being trapped in a place and having a building collapse on me. And all of these details appear in the book, and they're all very tiny, but it's like I just got to like cast them out of my brain and into the reader's brain. So I had a lot of fun doing that. Sadistic.
Like
it sounds sadistic when I say it, you know.
Well, it also sounds like you got to like make notes and comments on your own book, like by going back into the second.
Well, yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it's like I annotated it. Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
I actually really enjoy that. Claire wants to know how class figures into your idea of the overarching disasters in your book. So if you could each talk about that a little bit, because I think that does play a big part. And maybe we'll start with Jonathan this time to change it up.
Yeah. Well, I try to think my hardest to think about class every time I write. And I, as you know, Roman was reminding me, I'm a stranger in the space of this book. You know, the towns in Maine where I approximately set this book, I'm from away. Like not understanding them is part of my deep situation when I live there and now when I've written about it. And I think it's a study because I think that the kind of the integrity of that community has very powerful belief systems about class. And there are some really prominent things that anyone can notice, that like rich people from Boston and New York have houses, and people who live in the towns take care of the houses for them and the boats. And those people come, and for like 2 weeks, they use the houses and the boats. Well, so that's an easy, you know, that's fish in a barrel. But what about everyone in between, which is, you know, my situation and the situation of like a lot of people that I really am interested in and responsive to and spend time with, who maybe came and made a claim on that space because they wanted to make an organic farm, you know, at some point in the 70s. And now they're sort of, they're neither nor. They've made a connection that isn't recognizable to the five generations in the same farmhouse family and is totally consternating or peculiar, or, you know, or maybe they make a really great tomato, so they're like an asset to the people who come for 2 weeks with the boat and the house, but they're not class fixed. They're shapeshifters in a certain way. And I think, of course, this is something that I'm fated to write about again and again, whether I'm writing about urban spaces or other spaces. It's the problem of identifying with things that are not exactly your possession, and then accidentally gentrifying them. You know, this is a really uncomfortable space to be in, but it's something I'm very helplessly involved in thinking about.
Yeah, I'm similarly very interested in that material and that particular, what interests me is my own participation in the system as I understand it. And so when I am writing without mercy about these aspirational middle-class white people, I am also writing about myself, right? When I'm writing about the things they buy at the grocery store as the story of who they tell themselves they are, I'm doing that with a sense of recognition because I understand my own participation in this system. And I understand how ridiculous it is and how class is such a, like, it's like this myth that we keep telling ourselves about who we are, you know? And I find it really fun to think about and play with.
I want to end by, we've been ending a few of the discussions this way, it's been really nice, by asking each of y'all, you know, it's been like a time, to put it mildly, lately, and how it's like a week is a year and a day is a decade, like, I don't know. Yeah. How you've been, like, what is maybe one way that you've been finding joy this week, or like something that has comforted you or just like made you happy? Maybe we could start with Jonathan.
Well, you know, I do really count on cooking and eating. And then, you know, that forces you to notice the other side, which is getting on the treadmill. And so, you know, I think one of the things that's so interesting about this whole experience is the way it's double. You know, we've been centered in our homes and our bodies and our families. I mean, I spend enormous amounts of time with my kids in a way that I don't mean I neglected them before, but there's just a difference. I have to be sometimes the teacher and sometimes the playmate in a way that, you know, mostly really wouldn't be the case even for the 10-year-old, certainly for the 13-year-old, who would have dismissed me from his life by now, but too bad. He doesn't get to.
And you're stuck.
Yeah. So but we've been, you know, centered in these things, and it's very tempting if we're not in, you know, I mean, it's always crucial to note that some people are in free fall right now. They're suffering. Yeah. But if you're lucky enough to be in a home and know where the food comes from, and I'm that lucky, then being placed back and, you know, after we're done tonight, I'm going to cook this fish I bought, and the rest of what I put on it is herbs from the garden, which would not, you know, I used to be a big restaurant person, but these, I'll be eating things I grew. That's kind of cool. But then again, here we are, look at us, you know, I'm in Portland too, what's going on? No. I was in Texas this afternoon, you know? So we've had the whole experience of pandemic is one thing, and it's total opposite. We've been all completely translated out into our phones and into systems that we'd never even heard of, like Zoom. And what's this one called? VMix call? You know, I don't even know what. So how can a thing be so profoundly itself and its opposite? But I'm seeing people remotely. I mean, I'm spending this time with Ramana that I might, you know.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I might not have gotten to actual Portland this year. So it's weird. There are covert pleasures along with all of the forms of cognitive and emotional estrangement and as well as awareness of.
Yeah.
Of real suffering.
It is a strange moment. It's a strange, strange moment. I mean, I was telling both of you before we started recording that I'm teaching this semester, and I'm teaching undergrads at Pace and at Columbia. And I have found it like kind of a wonderful joy to spend time with these. There's a particular like kind of magic that happens in the seminar room, and I wish that we were in that seminar room. But when I see these, I call them kids, which is not generous because they are young adults, but when I see these kids on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I am momentarily lifted out of thinking about doing sixth grade math with my sixth grader, or the fact that I have to like figure out if I'm gonna make lasagna tomorrow or whatever. Like, I'm momentarily outside of those concerns, and I'm thinking about these young people and thinking about what gets them excited. And they're working so hard from their like girlhood bedrooms under these terrible circumstances, paying for these very expensive educations they're not getting the full experience of, and forcing these young readers to talk about the writers I love, like Brian Washington or Laurie Moore or Samantha Hunt. Like, I gave these kids Brian Washington's Lot to read this week, and I could see their physical responses to this book. I could see the extent to which it had changed their way of thinking about what was possible for them as artists. Samantha Hunt, that had exactly the same effect on them. And that is such a gift to be able to do that and to be able to watch a different reader respond to this text. And so that's been my joy. I've really, really enjoyed that experience. It's funny because I find so much joy in teaching these kids about the contemporary short story, and I find almost no joy in teaching my own children about third grade and sixth grade math. But maybe that's just my own failure as a parent. But I think you have to, like Jonathan said, we're so lucky in this moment. We're so lucky. This government has given working people $600 in the last 9 months. Like, we are such lucky people. And so you have to just seize the opportunity to take joy wherever you can find it, I think. I think it feels like almost a rebellion, you know?
That's a great answer, Ramon. It's the case for me as well, that my students, my college students, have been extraordinary. And in so many different circumstances that they've been thrust into as they were pushed away from their college life, they've rallied and come to these occasions of the teaching and brought so much to it. It's really something.
That was Ruman Alam and Jonathan Leatham from the Portland Book Festival in November 2020. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Hahn, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehahn.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast, with production oversight by Amanda Bullock and support from Liz Olofsson. Special thanks to Jyoti Roy and Alana Phelan and the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.